I'm a stranger here, Lord. I'm a stranger everywhere. I'm a stranger here, Lord. Stranger everywhere. Yeah, I could go home, but I'm a stranger there. Ain't it hard to stumble when you've got nowhere to fall? Ain't it hard to stumble on when you've got nowhere to fall? When
that's Richie Havens with I'm a Stranger Here. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Friday, November the 22nd, the 50th anniversary of one of the most investigated and still not conclusively solved crimes in the United States history, the assassination of President John F. Kennedy in Dallas, Texas, just 2 months shy of his third year in office. Kennedy became a president at a time that the world was experiencing dramatic social, political, and economic change and transformation from colonies to independent nations, the stubborn and willful expansion of empire, the race to outer space, East-West ideological tensions played out in deadly conflicts all over the world. The Kennedy years saw the rise of a counterculture that directly confronted and established the established old order, gave rise to a popular movement against war, and the revival of the ubiquitous struggle by African Americans for human rights, justice, and equality, whether moderately through negotiation and compromise or radically by any means necessary. In this regard, the liberal Kennedy was as unenthusiastic as his conservative predecessors about changing the long-standing social order, the most pervasive evil in the United States. He had to be pushed, embarrassed, even threatened into altering, even in minimal ways, America's racial codas. He was no match for racism. Our guest today, Dr. Joel Koval, helps us understand racism in a very different way. Not as he says, the simple delusion of a bigoted and ignorant minority, but as a set of beliefs whose structure arises from the deepest levels of our lives, from the fabric of assumptions we make about the world, ourselves and others, and from the patterns of fundamental social activities. Dr. Koval actually is a doctor on three counts, a doctor of medicine, of psychiatry, and psychoanalysis, and in fact became very much involved in leftist politics in the 60s, the same era, against the Vietnam War and domestic injustices. And so he started a fourth career, and that is writing. He has written, in fact, 10 books, the first of which is going to be talked about in our conversation today, titled White Racism, a Historical Analysis, a psycho historical analysis. And he's written also The Age of Desire, Against the State of Nuclear Terror, In Nicaragua, History and Spirit, and Red Hunting in the Promised Land. He also is very much involved in ecological issues and ecological struggle, and has written books pertaining to that subject as well, Capitalism, Nature, and Socialism, and The Enemy of Nature, and Overcoming Zionism is his current work in progress. And I'm so delighted that you can join us today to talk about how we see ourselves and the issue of white racism. So let me start there. Why do you define it the way you do?
Well, first of all, let me say hello. And let me say how happy I am to be talking to you now.
Thank you.
It's impossible not to take into account the very momentous anniversary that you referred to at the beginning of your comments, and in my case, even more so because I'm calling from New York State, and New York City, rather. I live near Riverside Church, and just a half an hour ago, they were pealing the bells very movingly, and I, in any case, had to relive that, thinking what a long time and yet what a short time 50 years is, and how our whole lives have been moved around by this. And I quite agree that Kennedy was very reluctant adversary to the racist consensus of his time, which, of course, was embedded in the Democratic Party's majorities in the South. And that's a stupendous story in and of itself. I think Kennedy's assassination took place because, as few people quite realize, he was very much concerned to stop the war machine. He had regretted it greatly. And he was a president who, although he started off very badly, showed the capacity for change, and he was murdered as an account of that. But I did white racism and psychohistory because I found myself as part of the war machine as a very reluctant psychiatrist. I never went to Vietnam, but I nevertheless had to give up some years of my life, and I saw the iniquities of the war. I saw how it deformed people's lives. And it took me a long time as a bit of a personal transformation. Actually, what I'm working on now is my memoirs, and that'll be talked about at length in my memoirs, but I'm not going to have time to go into the detail there. But I felt that I could best approach it from the standpoint of the raging crisis over racism. At the time of my writing, we were undergoing a sort of outburst of many urban uprisings, which were called riots, and had many more sides to it than that. And there was a lot of fear and terror, and the establishment was trying to control the matter by sort of bringing the black family together. There was a man named Daniel Moynihan who became senator from New York, and he wrote a report in 1965 which was named after him, and he said the problems with the blacks was the black family, that black men were not around, which of course is a fact of sort, but he was making it at the causative fact, you know. And he said that the best thing we can do is integrate the black families and black men into the U.S. military. And that was a flashpoint for me, because at that point I said, I've had it with this militarism and this war, and now they're trying to control racism by making, you know, blacks part of the U.S. military machine. And so that really set me thinking, and I took a multiple approach to it, and there are some basic assumptions that I made, and as I developed that book, and that because racism wasn't really about the blacks so much as about the whites, and that's why I called it white racism, And I think that studying racism in this country, you have to regard it as this terrible deformation of the identity of the dominant European fractions who put together the rule of this country, and have always sought a kind of identity that could could reconcile the various parts of their own existence, and did so, of course, by creating this category of the black. Now, that's one big point, and the other big point was I wanted to really root it in history. It wasn't simply a psychological phenomenon. This was kind of a rebellion on my part against being a psychologist and psychoanalyst, because I could see there was a lot wrong with those professions, which I was to leave not too long afterwards. And that the real issue was that we had a history in this country that established a kind of mindset, so that the mentality was really a function of history, although the mentality also became part of history. And clearly the history in question was the history of slavery. The agony of slavery, one of the two great crimes upon which our society was founded, the other being the extermination of the native people, so they were very much related. And there were many connections between the blacks and the reds, so to speak, redskins, all of which had to be kind of expelled and made into the other. And this all grew out of slavery. And the other thing I held as a basic principle was that racism wouldn't ever go away until our society was transformed. You couldn't legislate it. You couldn't psychoanalyze it. You couldn't put people into, you know, focus groups or encounter groups. It took hold in the individual mind, but it took hold in the individual mind because of the way people were forced to live in this society of capitalism and its empire and so forth, which gobbled up so much of Africa and the global South. And it was this this terrible dilemmas that resulted from that, trying to incorporate people who had to be regarded as subhuman into a social fabric. And that was done as in part by things such as, you know, the slave states would be enabled to count their blacks as 3/5 of a person in order to qualify themselves for inclusion into American democracy. So right there in the founding of American democracy, you see a radical dehumanization, where a whole vast portion of the society, and the portion that was super exploited, terrorized, and treated like animals, suddenly had to be regarded as less than fully human. So you found racism, in that sense, built into the very fabric of the history of our society. And it keeps playing itself out in many, many ways. So in writing the book, I said, well, there are different categories of race, and those categories themselves reflected the movement of society as it went from one level to another, one stage or never. But it was never going to go away until we solve the most basic problems of our society. So those are like the three basic principles I proceeded on. One was centered on the identity of the whites. Two was see this as a function of our history, especially of slavery and what followed thereafter. And three was regard it as part of the whole of society. So sure enough, it hasn't gone away, has it? Although it's changed a lot, and there are a lot of very interesting manifestations and a lot of signs of social ferment that go on, and it remains just as vital a subject to study and encounter and transform as it was when I first began looking at it in the 60s.
In what ways would you say it has changed?
Well, I mean, there's a remarkable change in the fact that when I was growing up, I was born in 1936, so I'm kind of on in years. The idea of blacks and whites marrying each other was considered kind of unthinkable, you know, beyond the. I don't know the sociological figures of the time. You know, how many people, if polled, would say, well, do you approve of interracial marriages, and but it would have been very small. But currently, and it's most starkly revealed in the new incoming administration of the city of New York, you know, marriages between whites and blacks are not only commonplace, but they're regarded as normal and unexceptional by the vast majority of the population. Something like 83% in a recent poll thought that was perfectly all right. And so that to me is a change. It's a structural change, you know. Somehow people have come around to see that in a new light, and it shows that we're not incapable of change. On the other hand, there are many ways in which, you know, not only no change, but in some respects, new forms of racism, new, you know, kind of worsening of racism. Another way it's changed is that there's now a large, not so much large, but certainly growing middle class of professional and sophisticated African Americans, people who want their full share of the lives of the affluent and, you know, contributors to our society. Not that these huge amounts of concentrations of wealth, although some blacks have gotten quite wealthy. But really, there's, you know, there's a whole new class relationship. There was very small black middle and upper middle class in the 60s. Now there's a substantial one. So I don't follow those statistics because that's never been my kind of approach. But you can certainly see the difference. There's a distinct difference. On the other hand, I mean, you look at the reaction to the de Blasio and his wife and, you know, by this idiotic columnist on the Washington Post, Richard Cohen, who said that traditional people who observe this would have to stifle a gag on their part. In other words, people would, in his view, people should be to be horrified and even nauseated by it. That shows that he's totally out of touch. It also shows that this newspaper, the Washington Post, which is one of the dominant papers in our country, would countenance having a guy who would write such terrible stuff and reveal such a blatant degree of ignorance and racial insensitivity and plain racism at the same time. So it doesn't change, it changes. But the things that perpetuate racism now are those which in which the crises of our late capitalist society are being enacted in a really gruesome way. Originally, the Ku Klux Klan, which was of course the vigilante hard white racists of the Deep South, were people who were displaced and disempowered and lost their way after the Civil War, which, needless to say, quite scrambled the relationships between classes and races very much. And these were small rural areas in the South. and they came together in this obnoxious and not yet extinguished form. Now you have a much larger class of angry white men who have been themselves displaced because the economy, the capitalist economy, has been in constant crisis since the 70s, and the crisis has been remedied by a strategy called neoliberalism, which means really basically come down really hard on labor, really hard on working classes, and to deprive cities of their social services and the like. So you now have terrible, terrible dislocations across the American landscape, in the South, but also in the West, the Midwest, and on the Plains. And you have very large numbers of really angry, dispossessed white men who are not at all inclined to avoid, you know, traditional forms of racism. They want to find a scapegoat. They want to find you know, somebody to blame for all this, somebody they can look down upon, and so they're reviving a lot of the racism. Then you have, you know, the collapse of the cities. You have this ghastly event that took place in Detroit a week or two ago, where a 19-year-old black woman got out of her car and approached a home to seek help because the car had broken down, and the guy just blew her away right through the screen door. So it's a sign of just how as our urban fabric has decayed, as the rural communities have broken up, hundreds of thousands of farmers have been displaced from the land, hundreds of thousands, millions of workers have lost meaningful employment, and been forced to take bottom feeding jobs and working 2-3 jobs and so on. The miseries of this population, which are very structural, induce reviving the kind of traditional racial categories. And above all, and hovering above it all, obviously we have the complications ensuing from having the first African-American president in the history of the United States. So that on the one side is clearly a vast step forward, as is the fact that, his attorney general is African-American, and his secretary, his national security advisor is African-American and the like. But it's hard to avoid the fact that the president is a black man has become the lightning rod for a vast amount of really dangerous racist invective. There are more death threats directed against Obama than any other president in history. The Secret Service, I forget the exact number, has something like 20 or 30 a day that they have to check out. They're working overtime. They have to put on more agents just to keep him from being assassinated. So it's a turmoil, isn't it? Some very good things happening, some very highly destructive things happening. And as I said at the beginning, I didn't think it was any doubt about it then. I don't think there's any doubt about it now. Racism is a function of the overall health of this society, and it's a way in which our own history comes back to haunt us and to plague us. And that's going on even before our eyes.
In the sense that you combine the psychodynamic perspective with history,
yeah.
Let's say the year 2043, when the nation is supposed to shift demographically from to a majority-minority country.
Right. Big change.
What would you see happening there with respect to how racism might express itself?
Well, actually, that's a very good question. I like that question a lot. I think sometimes racism is a way of people sort of holding on to the past. And at a certain point, they have to let the past go to some degree. I think as a society becomes one in which minorities turn into majorities, and of course we're not talking about obviously not a majority black population, but a majority black, brown, and Asian population. I see a demographic there which would encourage yet a further dissolution of the racist fabric. It has to, because politicians are not, they may be pretty bad, but they're not that stupid that they won't come around and try to work with the new emerging majorities, which are in a way, is the case in New York City even now. And I think that there's a very clear possibility that the Republican Party is going to go under because of this, because their base of support is more these angry white men than anything else. But time changes all things. Nothing can stand the the unfolding of events, and there are fewer and fewer of them all the time, and there's a few smaller and smaller base for the Republican Party. So I actually, I'm not sitting around and waiting for this to happen. I think we have to be very active. I don't think I'll be around in 2043. I'll be, 120 years old then, pretty much, and it's not going to happen. But it'll be interesting to see. But I think long before that, I think even now, what's happening is that there's a substantial shift to the left in the American population as a whole, because all these underclasses are now becoming empowered, and that shift is being detained and delayed by the the ferocious and often successful taking over of the political process by the richest people who still protect white privilege in many ways and represent the Eurocentric ruling class elites from before. But there's always kind of a, as you might call, an asynchrony. Things don't move synchronistically. One part moves fast, another part moves slower, and so there are tensions building up between them. It's fascinating. I think very much that there's going to be a breakup of even more of this white, displaced, angry men block that's holding the Republican Party up. And I see and kind of look forward to seeing the Republican Party collapsing, and also the Democratic Party dividing in two. And of course, there's tremendous class differences within the Democratic Party as well. And there'll be a reconfiguration in American politics. It cannot help but have a major effect on racial relations. I don't see exactly how that's going to turn about. I wouldn't be surprised if by 2043, racism plays less of a role in our society. I think there are other issues that are emerging which are going to play an ever greater role. And then there's a difference between our society and the other societies around the world. To me, the biggest effect is the biggest problem we have is this ecological collapse, the oncoming of climate change and the enormous destabilizations. We're facing a future in which almost everything is going to be rewritten and rethought through. And to me, the big question in the future is how do we contend with that? And I don't think you can contend with that unless you face the capitalist system itself and try to build an alternative to it. And to build an alternative to it, you most definitely have to break with the existing racist lines of force. But at the same time, the powers that be are going to try to hold on to the past. They're going to try to keep constantly reconstituting their white vigilante underclasses. And we'll see how that's happening. But time is not on their side. But I don't think time is on anybody's side, because unless we deal with those problems that have to do with the what people call the environment, but it's really our ecology, we're not going to have a future at all.
Do you think that the liberals as a group somehow have gained ground in an understanding of racism and therefore are reacting differently? Or do you believe that neoliberals are in fact very much a part of the problem of racism in the United States?
I take the latter position. I grew up in a conservative family, and so it took me a while to get my political bearings. It's still a process that's unfolding. So for a while, I thought well of the liberals, but as I grew and developed, and as time marched on, I realized that liberals are people who, try to compromise and make do, but they ignore the fundamentals. They ignore the fundamental principles upon which things rest. So they're constantly delaying, temporizing, and of course they're relatively successful. I mean, most of our institutions are built on liberal principles, from academia, to churches, or even schools. And you know, there's something in that, but the basic problem with liberals is that they do not they're too comfortable. They don't feel the pain. They don't feel the pain of the underclasses, and they don't recognize the underclasses as such. And the same thing occurs with respect to people of color. I don't think that liberals have a very good record on this. Of course, they want peace, but they want peace that doesn't transform anything. And you have to transform things. We're facing a very, very revolutionary period. I think we're just at the early stages of it. Of course, basically, the sense that the capitalist system itself is going downhill rapidly, or slowly, wherever, it's definitely going downhill. It doesn't deliver the goods. It doesn't. It's not able to provide anything close to full employment. It's constantly chewing away at the gains of working people. And you know how much worse the average worker is in this country than he or she was 40 years ago. And that's a structural thing. That's a reversal. And liberals are defined by definition as somebody who don't really see the urgency in that, because they have a pretty decent life themselves. They're not hurting. There's always something for them to do, so to speak. The great newspapers echo their concerns. The media, the mass media, you know, speaks back to them. You open up the evening news, and you're going to get the liberal consensus reflected back to you. So there's a comfort in that, but it's a comfort that's to use a tired but true statement. It's like the comfort of the deck chairs on the deck of the Titanic. And this is not helpful. You have to have people who are cognizant to the emergencies that we're going to be facing in the future.
What should a white person understand about white racism?
Well, I think the white person should understand that it is white racism, and that it's a big problem in being white, and that our own whiteness is built on the corpses and the graves of conquered societies, indigenous societies, not just here in this country, but all of the world has been consumed by the advancing white Western civilization. And we have to get away from that, you know. If we don't, we're just going to be high and dry. And the world is definitely approaching a situation of very different configurations, and the whites have to realize that white identity has to be surpassed. And the simplest way of looking at it has to be seen as a more universal identity. We have to realize that we are indeed one species, and that all the people who have been pushed aside by history, and all the people who are not considered, you know, capable of progress and the like, are people just like us. And if there's going to be any solution to all this, that has to be overcome. And it can't be overcome as long as one maintains and holds on to this dominant identity of white people. Whiteness is reason. Whiteness is full humanity. Whiteness is the idea of progress and all these things. I mean, I drew all these connections in the book that I wrote, White Racism. And I'm proud of that book, although I'm also ashamed, because I wrote it at a time when I didn't have a very firm understanding of the underside of society. I hadn't really discovered Karl Marx, and so I was writing it as a culturally aware and politically aware psychoanalyst, but then, so I dragged in psychoanalytic categories that really didn't work. But nonetheless, I made that point very clearly, and I think the point is, has to be very much well taken. We don't live in a white dominant world anymore, and it's good riddance. The white dominant world is, you know, what gave us, you know, the atomic bomb, so to speak, and we've laid waste the planet, and it's better that we get beyond that and see ourselves as citizens of the earth and members of a common humanity. And that means, you know, being able to practice, you know, mutual recognition between people. And at some point in my own life, I don't know how exactly it happened, but like one of those signposts. I grew up in a very white-oriented Jewish family that was quite racist in many of its ways. And when I was between my freshman and sophomore years of college, I took a job in a hotel as a busboy, and I had to live amongst the other kitchen staff, who turned out to be, you know, like 90% black. And I felt, oh my gosh, I'm going to have to spend my time with black people. I just didn't know what it was like. And for whatever reason, I found that I really took to them. I had a great time with them. And I felt more comfortable and at home with them. And than I did with my own kind. So I'm you know, like an odd person in that respect. But I'm proud of that. No need to be proud of it. You know, I'm not boasting about it. But I just think that's a necessary way to be. You know, for some reason, I never had a problem in that respect. And my people, my family thought I was kind of strange and weird. But it's too bad for them. They're leading the lives that are cut off from the deeper truth of things. And so my advice to white people is get over it. It's not worth it. There's very little there that's worth preserving. We're all one species.
Well, I wanted to know how you equate, or whether you equate, because you're working on this book on Zionism now, overcoming Zionism.
Oh, no, that's published already.
Well, you did that.
But I keep working on the problem, and I'm very eager to talk about that. So go ahead with it.
You're talking beyond Zionism, I think.
Well, the book is called Overcoming Zionism. It actually was published in 2007. But I keep working on that problem. So I'd like to
discuss that. Is there something that equates racism, Zionism?
100% equation. You cannot have a Zionist society that's not a racist society. It's a normal phenomenon because the essence of Zionism is that the society that is the fulfillment of the Zionist dream and ideal is a society with a state, and the state is the controlling, you know, institution of society that guides society and so forth. A state that's controlled by Jews. And so Zionism proposes a fantastically profound and phenomenal lie. I mean, I can't tell you enough, Eutrice, that I debated this so many times, and then how obtuse extremely intelligent Jewish people are. You know what I mean? People who won big prizes and are professors and are the top of the world. And then they'll come back and say, well, we can have a Jewish democratic state in Israel. No, you can't have a Jewish democratic state. There's a word, you know, called oxymoron. A Jewish democratic state is an oxymoron. Because if you have a Jewish state, it's for the Jewish people, primarily. Obviously, you can have different fates for the other the other people in the society. But those fates include always not being part of the upper echelons of society. So it's a society that's inevitably stratified, radically stratified, and can't be a democratic society. And yet, you still see our politicians lip-syncing in agreement with this notion that Israel is our friend, that we need to give Israel, you know, security and so on and so forth. And I got into a lot of trouble for writing this book because I have this tendency to go further than the average person. And in this case, I said, listen, we don't need Israel, you know. Israel is not necessary. It's not good for the Jewish people because it just exposes them to the hatred of millions of others. And it's very important. I mean, there's this notion of whites shedding their white identity. Well, it's the same thing if obviously not all Jews are white, but I'm saying, but a Jew should definitely get over the identity that he or she is entitled to rule over this country. and everybody be better for it. You know, we're not talking about harming anybody. The apartheid regime in South Africa was changed, extremely imperfectly, to be sure, but it was changed so that it was no longer a white-ruled society. And very few whites were killed. A lot of blacks were killed, but that was fomented by the outgoing, you know, ruling elites. Well, the same thing could happen to Israel. Same thing should happen to Israel. And I think the same thing is going to happen to Israel, because what we're seeing now is that the Zionist consensus is breaking up all over the place. The majority of young American Jews no longer have much support for, even interest in the state of Israel. There's a big split within the Jewish population. The majority of peoples around the world regard Israel as a menace to the future. Even now, the United States government is beginning to turn against Israel, which is a big turning point. So I think that there's going to be a lot of struggle ahead again, and you're not going to wake up tomorrow and it's going to be all taken care of. But if you take a long view, Zionism is racism. And once people realize that, and once people realize that racism is the most fundamental way of denying the common humanity of people, our being as an entity in this world, as a universal, that's racism, denies it. And Zionism denies it. And just as, you know, the antebellum South denies it, just as, you know, Jim Crow regimes deny it, just as apartheid South Africa denies it, and so on and on. Those lesions of the racist depression will continue so long as humanity does not find itself as a universal species. And we should all fight for that.
We're talking with Dr. Joel Koval, who is fixated on this question of justice. I'll say justice, on justice.
Oh, fixated, yeah, okay, on justice. I'll cop to that.
And
like Amos, you know, justice come down like an everlasting stream, like everlasting waters of justice. Yes, yes, in the Bible.
888-874-4888 for your questions to Dr. Joel Koval. And I wanted to ask, while people are getting themselves together, calling in, I noticed that in your bio it states that you, in 2012, just last year, you were baptized into the St. Mary's Episcopal Church.
Oh, yeah.
And you're writing a memoir to explain that. And also, I was going to ask, if I were to place, you know, amateur psychoanalyst here for a minute, I would say that are you trying to get rid of your own Jewish character?
No, because that's already been accomplished. These struggles over the years, and it's too long to go into in the few minutes we have left, and my memoir will take it up in detail, with struggles of that sort, and particularly the struggle against Zionism, made me realize that a lot of people, Jewish people, who are, you know, will sign the proper petition and so forth about Israel, they still cling to an identity that's very tribalized, the Jewish identity. And I feel that, you know, blood isn't thicker than water. Just because something has been your heritage doesn't mean it's a good thing. It's not a good thing, the tribal identity of Israel. Very bad thing. And I overcame that. I didn't work at overcoming it. It was just that the struggles against Zionism, plus other things in my childhood, which I can't take the time to getting into now, led to the point that, of course, I admit that I was born Jewish. I'm not afraid of that. And there's a lot of things I deeply admire about the contributions of Jews to our civilization, and so forth. And I've had some very, very powerful, and still do have some very, very powerful friendships with people who retain a Jewish identity. But it's not a Jewish identity with tribal attributes. That's the key thing. And unfortunately, the Jewish identity can be pushed in a tribal direction and has been pushed in a tribal direction by Zionist institutions and, you know, by the power of the Zionist role in politics. In any event, I discovered my faith as a Christian early on. It began in my college years. I didn't understand what was happening to me. I had many moments of sort of like mystical illumination. And it gradually became clearer that there was something vying for my soul. And it became very clear during the 80s because I went to Nicaragua during the 80s, and the Sandinista revolution was something I supported with a great deal of passion. And but that was a revolution made by radical Christians, you know, more than anything else. And I learned to work with Jesuits there and started taking communion and sharing things of that sort. And it was held back for a while, but once I was fired from my last academic job, which was at Bard College in 2009, for a number of allegations, but the principal one was that I was too strong as critic of Zionism, and because they're very Zionist and they couldn't stand the fact that I was calling attention to all their problems in this respect. So they got rid of me, but that was a big fight, but I was much better off for it. And there's this little church in Harlem called St. Mary's Episcopal Church. One of the people who's been very close to it is Benjamin Jealous, the outgoing president of the NAACP. He actually endorses our church. We're finding a new rector now, and Jealous has written saying, you know, St. Mary's Church is a powerful spiritual force. And I found the same way. And as, again, it's part of the same thing. It's a largely black church, and I like that a lot. And it's very very congenial to me. So, yeah, you know, no, nothing to be ashamed of there, but I just can't go around with a big sign on my back saying, oh, I've been baptized. But in fact, I have been baptized by Reverend Earl Cooper Camp on April 8th, 2012, at Easter Sunday. And it's a very happy day, and I've been very happy with it ever since.
Well, you know, I was. It was interesting that you had any religious affiliation at all, considering
well,
most
right.
people I know who are radical don't.
Yeah, but I think they're making a big mistake. Big mistake.
That's your next book.
No, that's the memoir. It comes out in the memoir too. But you know, for instance, I mean, hard to say who's the greatest radical, blah blah blah. It's a silly thing. But no question, Karl Marx is about as great a radical as you could come up with, right? I mean, everybody agrees with that. Karl Marx was not only hostile to religion. Karl Marx actually was a baptized Christian, and although people think of him as Jewish, but he wasn't. He was baptized when he was a boy, and he didn't believe that the Christian religion, as it was constituted, was the way to humans being all that they can be. But he certainly was very supportive of authentic religion, and so was Engels. I mean, they said that the great revolutions of the 16th century were the peasant wars in Germany, and then a man named Thomas Munzer, who led the peasant war, who was a priest, and throughout history, priests and pastors of various kinds have been in the forefront, and they should be in the forefront, because if you read the Gospels and if you take that all very seriously, you'll see that the message of Jesus is a profoundly radical one and a radically anti-capitalist one. I mean, why did Jesus get arrested and killed? He entered the temple, and he threw over the money tables. He said, you can't serve God and mammon, and mammon being the false god of money. And it's, you know, all that kind of stuff. Sooner a camel get through an eye of a needle than a rich man into heaven, and there's much, much more to this than that, than what I've said. And obviously, that's a whole other program, but no way. I mean, radical, to me, it goes to the root. That's what the word means. Most radicals, just like most liberals, do not do that. That's my critical attitude that I have. They don't recognize the deep spiritual forces at play in the radical transformational project. And we're all lesser for that. I think that our so-called radicals are not truly radical. They're just modernizers. And modernity has been brought many goods, but many, many catastrophes. Many, many catastrophes. And it's putting us on the edge of ecological destruction. So that's my position.
Is there a kind of process that people can begin to do, let's say, within the context of their own families, to examine their racist attitudes and to self-correct?
Well, I don't think there's a formula, but I think there's a big process is opening yourself to what's happening in the world. There's a lot of good stuff written about this. The debates are very active. I think it's really a matter of wholeheartedly participating in the life of one's times. Really living it. And when you do so, you're constantly encountering this enormous scar that was wrought basically by imperialism, as it developed, and basically by the triumph of the West. Because certainly there were racial differences, and a lot of differences between people, but they were all seen as localized. They weren't like put into this deep foundation. And you have, as you open yourself up to our history, and think through just what slavery meant, and how human beings were turned into commodities and the like. And there's so many pathways to this. There's no single, key that unlocks all the mysteries of racism. Just to repeat, I think it has to be, first of all, it has to focus on the identity of whiteness. It has to focus on the history of our kind, especially the history of slavery in the West and in the United States, which, remember, is different from all other kinds of slavery, right? We're the only slavery that was radically color-coded right from the beginning, not from the immediate beginning, but by the end of the 17th century, slaves and blacks had become the same category. And that was a huge force in the development of the pathology that haunts us now. So I don't think there's any simple formula. Just to maintain your curiosity, think deeply about the lives of our times. There's some pretty good films out there. I think the film, I don't know, we can discuss it in a few minutes you have left, 12 Years a Slave. I think it was a good film in this way. It's interesting. Some of my friends who saw it, have you seen that film?
No, not yet.
Oh, you should see it. Jeez, really.
I know. You know what? I have to work myself up to it.
Uh-huh. How come?
Those kinds of films just get me a little, they get me angry.
Uh-huh.
So
angry at the right thing? There's nothing wrong with being angry at the evil.
they rattled me a lot, and I find myself getting very angry leaving the movie theater. So I always have to steel myself.
Yeah, well, a lot of people are upset by seeing that film.
Yeah.
Yep, they're very upset by seeing that film. And they say, well, how can it, it portrays the slaves as being so submissive? Well, yeah, they were in the grip of a totalizing institution, an institution that controlled every facet of their lives. They had no recourse, no legal recourse. A white, master could kill a slave, and nobody would even bring a charge against him, much less convict him. And he was a law unto himself. There are a couple of features there that deserve emphasis. I don't think people have appreciated enough, but they're in the film. It's quite a good film. One is, and this is something almost out of time, is the sexualization of racism. It's very, very important. Most of the lynchings that took place were for alleged black transgressions against white women. And if you look back at the history of the colonizers in our society, in the Protestant areas of the United States, the settlers brought their whole families, and so the women were kind of exposed to, quote, the wilderness, unquote, and to the others. Whereas in, you know, in Spanish America, the conquistadors went over as men and they took up with the local women and their slaves, and, you know, quite unpleasant place and not at all to be recommended. But nonetheless, very different from what we see in the Protestant North. And in the Protestant North, you had this tremendous sexual complex. That's one thing I wrote about in my book White Racism, because I was a psychoanalyst and had quite a did I did have something to say on that subject. But you see it in the film. I mean, with the wife of the slave owner, who's played by Michael Fassbender, you know, is a very, very troubled, strange woman, and she actually, you know, she goes after Solomon, who's the, you know, the black who becomes enslaved after being free, and but meanwhile her husband is going after the African girl, and so you have this tremendous sexualization, and in a climate of complete terror, because remember that there was a constant fear of slave revolts, as there should have been, because they didn't have you know, an FBI then. They didn't have surveillance cameras. They didn't have, you know, all the things that exist now in the means of social control. The only social control they had was absolute terrorization. And that's what they did. And they treated not just like animals, but like devils. They treated their black slaves. And you see that in the film, and people get upset about that, you know. I mean, of course, you know, we're not talking about the alternative being with the gone with the wind notion, where the blacks are so happy and the whites are paternalistic and all that. But people don't realize just how far in the other direction slavery went, and it did go that far, you know. And it's good to see it. The truth shall make you free.
I'll steal my courage and go see it soon.
Do that.
But I want to thank you so much for being with us today and for this conversation, which was quite eye-opening.
Oh, good.
And it put a lot out there for people to think about.
Well, that's great. I always think about this subject, one of the prime subjects of my whole life, and I have a great need to communicate it, so I'm happy for having done that. How does one obtain a transcript?
Oh, it could just go right on the archives, and you can get a podcast.
Through what address?
Well, you go on prn.fm.
PRN.
.fm.
Oh, FM.
Right, and you'll see the show would be there.
Okay, great.
Thank you so much again. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, we've come to the end of our program today. I hope it was useful, and I hope it opened your eyes and certainly your brain to do some extra thinking about the subject matter, which is, you know, usually kind of avoided and evaded because it makes people uncomfortable. But it is important to get different points of view about something. And on this day, again, as America commemorates the 50th anniversary of the assassination of President Kennedy, it is important also to keep in mind that period in our collective history. So thank you so much, and we'll see each other Monday. Take care of yourselves and have a good weekend. Coming up next, Richard Martin with Wake Up Call.